Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. As we speak, Donald Trump is preparing to address a distinguished audience in the Rose Garden and to tell him what he intends to do about future U.S. participation in that agreement, fashioned at the end of the Obama administration and really, quite frankly, foisted upon his successor. I'm very pleased to say one of the people who will be in that Rose Garden is our first guest. He is Myron Ebel. He is the director of the Center for Energy and Environment at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He has been tremendously active on this front for a long time in a number of different capacities, including as the chairman of what he calls the Cooler Heads Coalition, which brings together dozens of very influential nonprofit organizations interested in this subject. He also served as the chairman of the Agency Action Team for the Environmental Protection Agency as the Trump administration prepared to come into office. He's a friend and colleague of many years. We're very pleased to have him. Myron, first of all, congratulations on what I think is the fruition of a lot of your work. And let's talk a little bit about it. Glad to have you back.
Thanks, Frank. And your work, too, and that of a lot of other people. And, of course, it's a little premature, but it's looking good that the president is going to keep his campaign promise and withdraw from the Paris Climate Treaty.
Well, we were certainly hearing that yesterday, and I gather that there's still some last-minute to-ing and fro-ing going on. But let's just talk for the moment, Myron, as though he is not going to carry on as Obama had essentially committed us to, albeit not in a treaty. It's important to say he wouldn't do that because of issues getting it through the Senate. But remind us what this agreement is about and why you have found it to be so problematic and unworthy of our continued involvement.
Well, you know, the whole global warming bandwagon going back to 1992 and the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which is the underlying treaty which the U.S. did ratify, the Senate ratified in 1992, it's an attempt to take government control and essentially international government control of the amount of energy we use and the type of energy we use. And so, you know, all kinds of good intentioned reasons or good sounding reasons are given for why that's necessary. But at the end of the day, it's a huge power grab, taking away people's ability to choose their own energy and how much they want to use and change the landscape so that energy becomes less and less affordable for people, which doesn't matter very much for international diplomats and bankers on Wall Street or CEOs of the companies that support this, but it does matter for poor people who have to work hard for a job and in their job and spend a very high percentage of their income on energy and food. And so this treaty is all about raising the price of energy for Americans, for Europeans, and eventually for everyone around the world.
And when you say, Myron Ebel, taking away, it's not just people inside our country sort of reallocating, you know, resources or access to energy. This is really something that involves a diminution of our sovereignty as well, does it not?
Yes, I think so, because the Paris Treaty, unlike the Kyoto Protocol of 1997, which never was ratified, and unlike the underlying framework convention, the Paris Treaty is perpetual. If we continue in it, we are required to present a new plan, a new commitment to reduce greenhouse gas emissions every 5 years. And so this, people say there's no legal obligation, there's no enforcement mechanism, but there will be a huge amount of political pressure put on globally and domestically for us to continue down that road once we've started it. So I think it does raise serious questions about sovereignty, and it's really about individual freedom and whether government knows better how much energy and, you know, what type of vehicle you can drive and how many lights you turn on and what kind of light bulbs you use, or whether people do. So I think this really cuts across not just economic issues, but a lot of issues of concern to conservatives over sovereignty and freedom.
Let me ask you quickly, Myron, to go through some of the putative benefits of this accord that we've been hearing a lot about of late from proponents of this agreement. One of them is that, this is going to be a great jobs program, that this is going to create for those participating, new industries, and that the industries will reward the countries involved by bringing great employment opportunities to bear. Obviously, Donald Trump is very big on employment opportunities in this country. He found that evidently unpersuasive. Why?
Well, you know, there are jobs and there are jobs. The renewable energy jobs are really a dead end because they are subsidized by taxpayers and mandated in most cases by state governments. There are no federal mandates on renewable energy, but 29 states have mandates, and there's tax credits for both windmills and solar panels. Here's a statistic, and I don't know how accurate it is because I heard it from an environmentalist whom I was debating on television. He said, well, there are only 50,000 coal miners employed at the moment, and there are 500,000 people employed in the renewable in energy industry. And, well, that's interesting because those 50,000 coal miners produce 10 times as much energy every year as those 500,000 renewable. So if there were 500,000 coal miners, they would produce 100 times as much energy. So, these are not high value jobs because the energy produced is not high value.
Let me ask you about coal, Myron, because, of course, a big piece of this whole project is essentially war on coal, as I think President Obama put it. We're told that at present prices, coal is not competitive in addition to being dirty. President Trump obviously has made a lot of commitments to coal miners and the states in which they work to try to help reconstitute their industry after the predations of the Obama administration. What's the way ahead for coal as you see it?
Well, the coal industry has taken two hits. One is that the shale revolution has expanded. You know, 10 years ago, we were running out of natural gas in this continent, and people were applying for permits to build LNG terminals to import liquefied natural gas. For the last 5 years, we've been the Obama administration has been dragging its feet on permits to build terminals to export natural gas. So we have a huge amount of natural gas, and it's very cheap. So coal was going to decline somewhat anyway, but the regulatory agenda of the Obama administration led to the premature closure of scores of coal-fired power plants. And it had nothing to do with gas because these plants are already paid for. They're decades old. They have many decades of life left in them, and they were closed down because of regulation. And the utilities had to take the hit in the stranded investment. So how does coal recover? Well, first of all, let's remove this regulatory rampage that the Obama administration was waging on coal, and then see what the market can do and what the coal companies can do, and then let's start permitting some export terminals for coal shipments, because globally, coal demand is continuing to go up as China and India and other developing countries use more and more coal because it's the cheapest source of high-value electricity. People say windmills are now cheaper. Well, if that's true, then they don't need subsidies and mandates. But the fact is windmills are not cheaper because they don't produce high-value electricity, because when demand is at its peak is when the wind typically stops blowing.
Yeah, I hate that. It's a real problem. There's so much more to talk about this. I look forward to doing so with you, Meyer Niebel, after what is, I hope, a very successful time in the Rose Garden today. Congratulations for the hard work you've put into this, both at the Competitive Enterprise Institute and with the EPA transition team. And we'll look forward to talking to you on the other side. Be well in the meantime, my friend.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.